Good morning. Thank you, everyone, for coming to the wastewater reuse panel, where, as Professor Yeh put it so elegantly in a tweet last night, we will spend the next 75 minutes talking shit. We have a great lineup and plan to devote most of the time to your questions. So let me make quick introductions and we'll begin. I'm Cynthia Barnett. I'm a Florida-based journalist who's written two books about water, most recently Blue Revolution, Unmaking America's Water Crisis. When I was reporting that book, I kept hearing people, water people, describe Singapore as the gold standard for water sustainability, as the first country that was really capturing every single drop of water that falls on the island. So I knew I had to go to Singapore, and I ended up devoting a chapter to how the country lives with water, including its wastewater to drinking system, which is new water and produces these lovely little bottles. And anyone who wants to try the new water after the panel, grab a glass from the back, come up, and we'll all drink a little new water. So anyway, I'm thrilled to introduce George Madovan, who's come the farthest of all SEJ speakers this year. So George, we really appreciate the distance you came to share Singapore's water story. George is a director at Singapore's Public Utilities Board, the National Water Agency. He oversees public communications and community relations, including building awareness and trust in new water, which is a high-grade water purified from wastewater via microfiltration and reverse osmosis. Singapore picked up a lot of its research on waste to drinking water from California, where we have with us Ron Wildermuth, Public and Governmental Affairs Manager for the West Basin Municipal Water District, which sells five different types of designer waters. I love that euphemism. Love it. Made from recycled sewage to cities and private industry in southwestern LA. So prior to West Basin, he spent 10 years at the Orange County Water District, where he was the guy who sold the public on the groundwater replenishment system, which is the largest indirect sewage to drinking water project in the world. And finally, I'm happy to introduce Daniel Yeh, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of South Florida, where he works on sustainable urban water infrastructure, including wastewater reuse and recovery and bioenergy. So I've asked Daniel to go last because he's really good at putting all of this in the larger context for journalists. How sustainable really are the waste-to-drinking systems, and what does the future hold? And Dr. Yeh will also tell us about his research on a resource recovery machine that can harvest nutrients, energy, and water from human waste, and his work to cultivate biofuel producing microalgae from wastewater. So Ron is going to start us off, followed by George and then Daniel. And Ron, let me pull up your... Also, again, everyone is doing a really brief overview of their story that they've brought, because we want to make the majority of this panel, we want to put it in your hands and have you shape it. So they're all going to be off to about 5 minutes. Thank you, Ron.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Ron, and I'm addicted to purified sewer water. Just kidding. Can you hit the next slide?
Yep.
My job this morning is to start us off with a few definitions. Potable water is, of course, your drinking water that comes out your tap. And non-potable is recycled water used for industrial or irrigation use. Indirect potable water is purified water that either goes into a groundwater basin or reservoir to eventually become drinking water. And direct potable water is something we don't have yet, at least in the United States, where we purify the sewer water and put it directly into the pipes. that is a goal that we want to get to in the future. I'm from West Basin. We're a coastal LA water district. We import water from Northern California and the Colorado River and provide recycled water to 17 cities, about a million people. I have some good news and some bad news today. The good news is that you're drinking purified sewer water already. The bad news is we're going to run out. Some basic reuse facts. All water is reused. I can't read this thing. Excuse me. Okay. Whenever there's a city downstream from another city, that downstream city is drinking the sewer water from the upstream city. We purify water to use, depending on what's needed for the particular use.
Ron, you want to trade with me? Sit here?
That's okay. I got it written down here. Thanks. The history of the water before you purify it is not as important as the treatment or the purification process you give the water. We can purify water faster and better than Mother Nature today. We can make water that's so pure you don't want to drink it. And recycling, of course, is the right thing to do. In the past, the reuse projects have probably been done without the public's knowledge. The groundwater replenishment system in Orange County was the first time we overtly went out to the public and said, we're going to make a new water project, we're going to purify sewer water, we're going to put it in the groundwater basin and inject it along the coast. And we were open and transparent and invited everybody to come taste the water and see the project. West Basin does make five types of designer water. We make irrigation water, cooling tower water, high pressure boiler feed water, low pressure boiler feed water, and like Orange County, we make water that goes into the groundwater basin to eventually become drinking water. We're working on a sixth water. It's holy water, but we're trying to figure out how to boil the hell out of the water. Just kidding. I am sorry about this.
That's okay. I'll forward it.
Okay. This is a diagram of our purple pipe system. The pink pipes are existing purple pipes where we move irrigation water. The blue pipes are where we eventually go as we double our recycling from 30 million gallons a day up to 70 million gallons. And those are a list of some of our customers. Direct non-potable is one of the hardest types of recycling you can do. You have to literally build the plant in phases as you get new customers, and then you have to put new pipes in existing infrastructure and streets as you get new customers. It takes a lot of time. You got to sell the customer on taking recycled water. It's much easier than just making purified sewer water and putting it underground, because we have to deal with 300 sites, several customers, and you got to meet their quality needs every day. So when you don't make it for drinking water, it's really a hard task. Indirect potable reuse. The groundwater replenishment system in Orange County actually took place after about three other type projects in Southern California failed. Now that has gone forward, we're now seeing Los Angeles and San Diego start the same projects. So that'll be an expansion of indirect potable reuse in Southern California, which is a great thing. We want to move toward direct potable, and we're working hard to do that. And that's where we purify the water and put it directly in the pipes. We make water that we can't move it unless we add minerals back to it. If you go to the grocery store and buy distilled water for your iron, we make a water that has 60 parts minerals. We make a water that has four. So we have the capability. What we don't have is the ability to to get the people to understand it. So there's four challenges that we need to overcome in order to put water directly into the pipes, and we're working on those. Outreach is the hard part of recycling. The technology's been around, Singapore's proven it, but getting people to get by the yuck factor is a real challenge. Next slide. I believe to do outreach and to get public support for recycling, you have to start with the community leaders and then work down. Number one, they're the decision makers that are going to say yes or no to your project anyway. And amazingly enough, if you can convince them that recycling is safe, they actually communicate downward for you. Next slide. Nationally, we need more water reuse education. We need to have the capability that Singapore has to bottle this for education purposes and go out in the community and let people taste it. It's anybody that tastes this water is 90% there for accepting this stuff. We need more stories about recycling successes from you guys. And we need to get the environmental groups to help us. They helped us in Orange County. They need to help us nationally. Big picture thoughts. Conservation, recycling, and ocean water desal are the three new future waters. Only one of those can you drink until we can get recycling so you can put it directly into the pipe. Sewer water directly drinking will happen. Ocean water use will increase. We need more water quality research, especially on pharmaceuticals and the combination of those. We need a national leadership on reuse. And right now, the water industry is going to be the driving force on reuse.
Okay. Thanks. I'm going to pull up George. George, would you like to sit here?
Okay.
And you can just, might be easier.
Okay, I shall start with a confession. I think I've incurred the highest carbon footprint getting here. Singapore is 10,000 miles away, and our main challenge with water is that we have one of the densest population in the world and a very small land area of 275 square miles, that's all Singapore is. So even if we collect all the rainwater that falls, we will not have sufficient. So from day one since our independence about 48 years ago, water played an extremely high priority in the nation's development. Okay, fast forward to 2001. This is where we had closed the water loop. Right, this is quite unique because we are one of the few countries where one agency manages the entire water cycle. In the past, when drainage was managed by a separate agency, the mission of that agency was to get rid of water as quickly as it fell, because to prevent flooding. But now that it is part of the water agency, the mission has changed to collecting and managing the water that falls from the skies. Right? So we collect two-thirds of the water that falls on the island, two-thirds we collect. And it goes to our 17 reservoirs, where it's treated, and it's sent to the population and industries. What happens after that is almost every drop of water that is used, we collect back. Right? Some people say, how can you collect back every drop? If I drink it, how are you going to collect it back? If you drink it, you need to pee, we collect back that. Right? So we collect back every drop of water through a set of sewers. Right? And the water that we collect back, it is known as sewage elsewhere, but we call it used water. Right? We think it's more accurate description of what it is. Used water, we treat it at the used water treatment plants to a quality that's clean enough to put back to the sea. Right? And this was the natural water cycle that was going on for a while until 2002. Instead of putting this treated used water back to the sea, we use it as feed water and put it through an advanced membrane treatment process to get ultra-clean water, something we call new water. And new water is used for industries, and we also put some of it back into our reservoir during the dry season to recharge our reservoirs. We have another source of water from desalination. So what we have now is four different sources of water. We have diversified our water resources. These two sources, water from our own catchment, and we also import water from our neighboring country, Malaysia. These two sources are dependent on the weather. When it is dry in Singapore, it is likely to be dry in our neighbor. So they are affected by the weather, which is very unpredictable. But these two sources, new water and desalinated water, they do not depend on the weather, they depend on energy and technology. So we now have a lot of control over our water supply. All right, and I'll talk a little bit about new water, introduced in 2002, and it currently has capacity to meet 30% of our needs. Okay. And we've got four plants, four factories all over the island. This is the map of Singapore. So you've got four factories, and these are the pipelines that brings the water to the industrial clusters. So it's really a massive island-wide water recycling program. Okay, very quickly, the process is a three-step process, right? The treated used water, the effluent, comes here. It goes through what we call microfiltration that removes the bigger particles and many of the bacteria. And the heart of the process is a set of membranes that does what is called reverse osmosis. And after reverse osmosis, you get ultra-clean water. It is very, very pure, purer than your normal potable water. But as an added measure, we do ultraviolet disinfection to get new water. Okay. Before we launch this product, we had to make sure it's quality. So we went through very rigorous testings. Our experts looked at it from all angles, and we were very sure of the quality before we put it out. And we got external validation. Professor Joan Rose, a toxicologist from the U.S., a whole external panel was invited to validate the quality of new water. So when we were sure of the quality of new water, then we went out with the public messaging. All right, we wanted to turn the psychological stigma and fear for drinking, used water, and to help people understand that every drop of water that we drink is the same drop that has been around 100 million years ago. It's just gone through a natural, longer recycling process, right? And to remove and to help with the mindset, we change some of the less pretty words. All right. So we engaged three set of stakeholders, the media being extremely important, and we actually brought our media partners to visit Ron's factory, all right, in Orange County, and Ron did hell of a good job in explaining to them, educating them, and when they came back to Singapore, they were our advocates. Right, and in Singapore, our political leaders have got a lot of trust and with the public. And when after they've understood the quality of new water, they were our advocates. This is founding Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew. This was the Prime Minister then, Goh Chok Tong. Right? Okay, so again, it's not just PR, right? We think it's important. Right. If you think of negative things, you tend to be negative. Whereas if you think of positive things, it really helps you to accept new water better. Right. And we've got a new water visitor center, a purpose-built exhibition center that has seen almost 1 million people since we opened. All right. And we bottle this for public sampling only. And this guy, if you recognize him, is Ban Ki-moon. Right. He was in Singapore earlier this year. Toasting new water. Right, my last slide, just some of the figures. We've been around for about 10 years, and actually our long-term goal is to increase new water from 30% to 50% of our. So it's really a pillar of our water supply system. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, George. Daniel, would you like to introduce the video that I'll quickly show? All right.
Okay, while Cynthia's pulling it up, so this is a video that Fox News did on our research related to recovering resources from wastewater. And it's, you know, quite interesting because Fox has, you know, certain reputation, and they thought this story was newsworthy. And and I have to tell you, Lois Sowers, the reporter, really got it right. I mean, he took a lot of time, sat down with us to understand the technology, understand where we're coming from, and we provided talking points, and it was a great partnership. And is, you know, oftentimes I think media is after something kind of sensationalized, but this is really for educational purpose, and they were willing to do that. So we're very grateful that they did that. And,
of course, it was working fine before you guys got here. Daniel, it almost looks like it's playing without...
Why don't we just hit refresh on the page.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So we've heard two great talks related to recovery of water from wastewater. And I want to basically talk about where the industry might be able to go to make it even more sustainable. So I want to introduce the concept of biorecycling. We're all familiar with recycling, but the idea that you use microorganisms to help recycle wastewater and what that's about. Some of my contributors to this presentation wanted to acknowledge them. And this is the link for it. Okay, so, right, wastewater is something that, you know, the first thing you need to understand about wastewater is all of us are responsible for that. Every single one of us, right? So there's a saying, you know, wherever people live, there's going to be wastewater. So if we can somehow kind of tag this as a renewable resource, we will never run out of it. We will never run out of wastewater because it is a renewable resource that follows people around. And the second thing I want to impress upon you is that if there's pollution that goes with wastewater, every single one of us is responsible for that. The wastewater treatment plants do not pollute. They intercept the pollution and turn into clean water. They do not generate the pollution, right? The pollution comes from us. They're there to clean up the water. So given that there's 7 billion people on the planet and growing, what do we do with this? So we know with technology we can turn really dirty water into clean water. We can do that. And, you know, depending on the wastewater treatment plant, the process, you know, complicated, has a variety of steps involving, you know, settling and biological treatment and so forth. But it comes at a cost. And the costs generally are related to energy. That's a huge energy cost to basically get rid of the pollutants in the wastewater. There's also chemicals and labor. And along with that, we basically generate clean water. That's the one product that we get out of wastewater treatment plants right now because of regulations, and we're able to, regulations such as the Clean Water Act, and we're able to do that pretty well. But it comes at a cost that, you know, we also generate some residues and a big energy cost. So, of course, recovery of water, we've heard from the previous two presenters, so we can do that pretty well, and there's a variety of technologies associated with that. So maybe a more sustainable approach, one more step beyond that is, hey, we're still going to get the clean water, but let's reduce the residues that we generate. And what do we do with those residues? Turn them into products such as fertilizer. We can call them bioproducts. I'd love to talk to, because of shortage of time, I can't go into all the details, but I'd love to sit down with any of you and get into all these things in more detailed fashion. But we can even make plastic, bioplastic, out of wastewater. So we have the potential to replace petroleum by deriving plastic from wastewater. And there's a variety of nutrients that we can harvest from wastewater and reconnect this to the agricultural industry to close the loop on these essential elements on Earth. Then probably even a more sustainable approach is to say, okay, we can get the water, the nutrients out, but let's go after the energy content and really reduce the energy and material input to make wastewater, right? So you can see, in this sense, the wastewater treatment plant of the future, it's almost like a renewable resource recovery facility. You know, we stop branding it as wastewater and really tag it as a renewable resource, and we look at it as a factory that derives water, energy, and nutrients and other bioproducts from there. That's, I think, where we need to get to in the future as a society. And to do that, we kind of need to recognize, well, what is in wastewater? Where does it come from? You know, there's a variety of things. It's generated here in the building and from the bathrooms, but it also is generated along the collection system. So, you know, environmental engineers such as myself, we spend a lot of time actually thinking about these things and to really focus on how do we get these resources recovered. So how do we get the energy out of wastewater. First thing is to recognize that the same problem that we may have with wastewater, the strength of the wastewater, you know, the same strength that can pollute our waterways, if we look at it from another angle, this strength of the wastewater that we would call chemical oxygen demand is actually the energy content of the wastewater. So really, the more polluted the wastewater, the more energy we can potentially recover from that. So it all has to do with how do we look at it and how do we kind of frame the discussion, the conversation, and the technology. So without getting into detailed conversations, I want to sort of give you an idea. Roughly, for a typical municipal wastewater, we can recover up to 1.74 kilowatt hours per cubic meter of wastewater. And that's, you know, under the perfect scenario, 100%, which will never be possible. Let's say if we even recover 25% of that, you know, that gives us to 0.44 kilowatt hours. Well, how much energy does it take to treat wastewater? And that, again, varies depending on the treatment configuration. But here I'm giving examples from one study and using, say, 0.3 kilowatt hours. So there's that potential that there's more energy within the wastewater than energy required to treat it. And energy wastewater treatment plants can potentially become energy neutral, first of all, because roughly 3% of our energy in the country is used for wastewater treatment. So that's quite substantial. So we can actually make a big dent in that by making wastewater treatment plants energy neutral. But in fact, if we go further, they might actually become energy providers. Sort of, you know, you have this smart grid with wastewater treatment plants producing energy. So how do we get there? How do we do this? The very first thing is, you know, go back to elementary school and really think about carbon cycle. And I think a lot of us forget that as we grow up, all the things we learn as you know, grade school students, is that carbon moves around the earth, matter cannot be destroyed, and there's this wonderful cycling of carbon that's done in nature, and it's done by aerobic organisms, it's done by anaerobic organisms. And so if we really look at it, it's this cycling of carbon that we're really trying to mimic, we can mimic within a wastewater treatment plant. You know, we can basically take biomass, and biomass could be the waste organic material, and the biomass could be broken down, become carbon dioxide, and it could be turned into methane, which is a useful fuel. Methane is 90% of our natural gas is methane. So we can make methane from wastewater using anaerobic digestion. And after biomass is oxidized to carbon dioxide, we can use photosynthesis to bring that back using algae. So there's a variety of techniques if we basically just go back to the fundamentals. I want to talk about two projects that we're doing in the lab that Cynthia mentioned. The first one is something called an anaerobic membrane bioreactor. This, I think, has a lot of potential to reduce the energy footprint of wastewater treatment, but also focus on recovery. Rather than getting rid of the bad stuff, let's recover the stuff that's in the wastewater. And so this is something that we have in our lab. It uses basically a membrane process such as are done in other places. And we basically use microorganisms coupled with membranes to recover resources. You know, this is a graph showing the nitrogen and phosphorus that's in the wastewater. We can recover almost 100% of that back in the water. And what did we do with this? So in the project with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Cynthia earlier mentioned that I used the hashtag talk shit in my tweet. Well, that's one that's being used by the global sanitation community now. The idea is that nobody really wants to talk about it. And the consequence of that is that 40% of the world's population do not have adequate sanitation. And every second, there's roughly three children die every second from diarrhea. Yeah. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation says, well, to do something about it, maybe we need to reframe the whole sanitation discussion and really look at wastewater as a renewable resource. And how do we do that? Let's promote technologies that could be done off the grid, without energy, could be cheap. You know, so poor communities can do this, slums can do this, and turn basically human waste into a commodity and solve the sanitation problem. So we're thinking, this is a technology we're doing with a process called New Generator, stands for Nutrient Energy Water Generator, recovery of these things. And the other project that we're working on is basically recognize that there's a lot of synergy between algae and wastewater. And the interest in algae now is that there's algae that can be rich in lipids, and that we can recover the lipids as biodiesel. So there's a potential for growing microalgae as a replacement for petroleum. And nature can do this, and we basically need to figure out how to better connect nature with wastewater. So you see, you know, the algae produces oxygen, which is needed in the wastewater treatment process. wastewater treatment process produces carbon dioxide, which could be used by algae. And the nutrients that we're trying to get rid of in wastewater could be refunded to algae. And there's energy that can be recovered. So we have a project with the National Science Foundation looking at how to do this now, working with the Tampa Wastewater Treatment Plant. And we came up with this great acronym, ICARUS, Isolated Cultivation of Algal Resources from Sewage. Yeah. So maybe we'll crash and burn like ICARUS did, but at least we'll give it a shot at. So maybe in the not-so-distant future, we can have this scenario where basically, you know, we can do on-site recovery of energy from waste. Okay, thank you very much.
You want to see if the video will play? Well, thanks so much to the three of you. Those were great presentations, and I just wanted to follow up quickly before I open it up for questions. We've been hearing a lot over the past few days about endocrine disruptors and other public health threats in our drinking water supplies. I heard George say that this had been tested so many times. There's a lot of certainty, but I had Ron say we really need more testing. So could you, either one of you, speak to the safety of using indirect or even direct sewage for drinking water?
Okay, let me clarify. When this water goes through microfiltration, reverse osmosis, and ultraviolet light, there's no pharmaceuticals, there's no endocrine disruptor, no personal care products. Everything is taken out. When I mentioned pharmaceuticals, I was talking about regular tap water. Right now, you'd have to drink about 50,000 glasses of water a day to get a dose of pharmaceutical. But the problem is we're mixing the pharmaceuticals, so we need to do more research to see what, you know, what's the future with pharmaceuticals. But mm-hmm. as far as recycled water, it's the best, safest water you ever get. It's better than Aquafina, DeSante, or Sparklets.
So who's got the first question? And I'll just remind you to you speak pretty clearly because we're recording this, and tell us who you are when you ask the question. Go ahead. This is a great point. Many communities downstream are actually relying on effluent, like in San Antonio, to keep the river full. And so maybe, Daniel, do you want to address that question of whether... And that goes into a question I have, too, about the big picture. To me, I wonder if the waste-to-drinking technology is something that just a few communities in the United States will have to get to, but the rest of us wouldn't have to get there if we would just learn to live with less water. So I wonder about that. So could you talk about that issue?
Well, so first, I think the very first thing we should always do is conservation, without a doubt. But the question is, you know, how far will conservation take us, and do we will have to recycle wastewater? So I think, you know, technology aside, it really comes down to your perception of the choices that you have. You know, when you don't have the choices, I think communities are very eager to embrace water reuse. When you think you have more choices than that, then you start to get kind of picky. So, for example, you mentioned San Antonio. You used the effluent from the previous town, and people actually want that. I'll give you an example from Tampa. Tampa has refused various types of wastewater reuse, indirect. They don't want the effluent from the local wastewater treatment plant be put back into the river because they think they have choices, you know, and then the choices could include desalination. So I think maybe I'll turn it over to my fellow panelists who have more experience.
Ron, in terms of that water being needed by natural waters and by ecosystems, by aquifers, rivers, and fish and wildlife, is that going to become an issue if we keep every drop of wastewater?
Yes. In Orange County, we have a river that goes to the county called the Santa Ana River. And we have upstream Riverside and San Bernardino counties who are starting to recycle their water as well, which means we get less flow down the Santa Ana River. So that is a concern, but the future is a diversified portfolio. And that means groundwater cleanup, recycling sewer water, conservation is huge. And so the more different types of sources of water, it's like your financial portfolio. if one can't be used because the downstream people need it, then you got to look other places.
Who's got the next question? Tom.
Well, we've been operating our new water plants for 10 years, and so far we have not had any lawyers knocking at our doors. So far, so good. Our water, the new water, is mainly used for industries, the high-tech industries, the wafer fabrications, the microchip makers, air-conditioned cooling. And they love this water because it is slightly cheaper and it's cleaner, right? And the water that is accepted by a wafer fab invariably is a more higher quality water because they cannot stand pollutants. It will destroy their wafer fabs, right? We put a little bit back into the reservoirs to remineralize it. So currently we don't send it directly to the customers. What we do is we bottle it for sampling for education. That's the current state of how we deploy the new water that we've created.
Daniel?
So this idea of basically, you know, recovering methane that you can use as a fuel to power different facilities. And of course, you know, the stronger the waste, the more methane you can recover. So landfills are a great source of methane, and that can complement wastewater treatment facilities. So Tom, I think what you're talking about is this emerging trend of basically recognizing the connection between water and energy, this water-energy nexus. This energy is required to treat water, but at the same time, we can recover energy from water. And if we extend that recognition to the utilities level, there are a lot of wastewater or energy facilities now that are doing co-location. They're looking at how to basically plan it together. And sometimes you have to break through barriers, and that these are different jurisdictions. They speak different languages, have different accountability. But we're kind of getting there. So I'm not that familiar with this particular case in Toledo, but I think it's a great idea that the bottom line comes down to is economics. You know, we can recover methane and other resources from wastewater or landfills, but it comes down to the economics, making it work. And one of the things that is currently sort of working against renewable biofuel is the really low price of fossil fuel. And a lot of that is, there's politics involved, but we also just opened up vast reserves of natural gas in this country, so natural gas prices are at all-time low. That could be good or bad for renewable fuel, I think. It's bad in that it basically says, well, we don't have to do renewable fuels because it's readily available from fossil fuel. But at the same time, I think that can pave the way for us to get used to using natural gas, and at some point we will run out of natural gas, and then the renewables can readily step in to take over.
I think Daniel is a good person to answer that question, but I would direct you to Cape Cod, where some similar challenges were going on, and they've helped residents transition. I think they're called package plants, transition to a different sort of sewage treatment that is not hooked up to the major plant, but nor is it the kind of polluting septic system that we had in the 20th century. So there's really a lot going on in Cape Cod, and I can also give you a couple of sources there after the panel. Daniel, could you tackle that one?
Sure. Yeah, well, the question you ask is very difficult to answer because here we are, 2012, and we still can't fix a septic tank problem. A big percentage of the U.S. population relies on septic, and the thing with septic is if it's maintained properly and it was installed properly, it's fine. The problem is most of the time, there may have been some problem with installation, and the inspection and maintenance is very difficult. And now with budget cutbacks, a lot of health departments are actually cutting back on inspections. So, these are kind of basically very passive systems that might just not be operating correctly and nobody knows. So as you mentioned, Chesapeake Bay is getting huge nitrogen loadings affecting the water quality. So there are people looking into different technologies, basically how do we improve septic tank design so that it really can be more robust and remove the nitrogen. Part of it is basically complete that nitrogen cycle and return the nitrogen to the atmosphere. The technology I'm working on might play a role, but, again, we're still in the development stage for that, and our target right now is really for developing countries to recover. But maybe a fundamental part of that is the recovery of nutrients. Rather than trying to just get rid of it, is be able to close the loop somehow and recover that. But the issue you're talking about is prevalent in Florida also. We have a lot of nitrogen issues in Florida. And I'd love to talk to you more about that afterwards. Sure.
I remembered the name of my source when Daniel was talking, and she was on our panel last year at SAJ in Miami. It was Valerie Nelson with the, I think it's the National Alliance for Wastewater Efficiency. And what's been really interesting in Cape Cod is the pushback they've gotten from the people who build old-fashioned water infrastructure are saying, they're advising, no, we don't want the plants that are smaller, that cost less. We want to keep building the kind of plants we've always been building. So it's actually become a very interesting political issue, and she's a great source on that. Please raise your hand all the way in the back. Yes. That's a great question. She's asked about the cost of treating effluent to drinking water standards, which is a really big issue. We kept hearing over the past 2 days about the increasing cost of energy to make water and water to produce energy. So could you, maybe George and Ron, both mention how much it costs to do your new water versus other sources?
Okay, maybe instead of cost, I will use the ratio of energy required. So if treating effluent to new water is 1 unit of energy, desalination requires about close to 4. Conventional treatment is about half. So actually recycled water is a fairly low energy way of recycling water. What we are doing is we are doing a lot of R&D to even try to bring down the energy required further. For example, the old way of desalting water requires 15 kilowatt hour of energy to convert 1 meter cube of seawater to fresh water, 1.5. Using our current technology, reverse osmosis, it is 4 kilowatt hour of energy. We are doing research and we are successful in a lab to bring it down to 1.5 kilowatt hour. But theoretically, the most efficient desalting plant is your kidney. So we are trying to understand how the kidney desalts, something called biomimicry. And if we can achieve that, we are looking at about 0.7 kilowatt hour of energy to convert 1 meter cube of seawater to fresh water. That will be a major breakthrough.
Ron?
Yes. Our imported water in Southern California right now is about $1,000 for a unit of water we call an acre foot. It's the amount of water to cover an acre to a depth of 1 foot. It's 326,000 gallons. So we're importing water at $1,000 an acre foot. We can make this indirect potable water for about the same price.
Mm. Wow. Okay. Yes, right here.
Okay. So in terms of the non-recoverables, the first thing to remember about wastewater is there are solids in there, obviously. But, you know, the solids that are in the wastewater is really less than 0.5% of the wastewater. Most of it is just water. So the residues I'm talking about really has, a lot of it has to do with the way we currently treat wastewater, in that we are basically swapping pollution for microbial cells. We're using microbes to treat the wastewater. And well, microbes don't work for free. They take a commission. So if you want them to remove the pollutants from wastewater, they're going to live off of it and grow fat. And basically, you know, and we have to constantly basically get rid of the excess microbes that grow. And that's something we would call sludge or, you know, waste sludge. So what do you do with that? So the first thing to remember about wastewater treatment is there's two things that come out of a wastewater treatment plant. One is the clean water, and the other is this solid stream, the sludge that's being generated. So using conventional activated sludge aerobic type of treatment processes, we generate a lot of sludge. Roughly 45% of the energy equivalent that's stored in wastewater gets diverted to the sludge. So it's basically pretty substantial. So what do we do with that? Well, you can either just landfill that directly, which is not a good way to do it, or you can try to reduce that volume. So using anaerobic digestion, such as what you talked about, is a great way for reducing that sludge volume and actually give it a second life, turn it into methane. You know, but at the end of that process, you're still going to have some residues left because not everything can be biodegraded or biodegraded within a time frame. You know, but at least we have reduced that portion considerably. And so one thing we're looking at is maybe we can bypass this entire activated sludge process. Don't make that sludge in the first place. You know, go to anaerobic processes to treat the wastewater. If you're looking at it in terms of commission values, I mentioned that aerobic microorganisms take a 45% commission. Anaerobic microorganisms take a less than 10% commission. So they basically make a lot less sludge and basically reroute the pollutants to make methane directly. You know, so I think that's, in terms of wastewater treatment, that's a future direction we need to go to. And the thing you were talking about, East Bay Mud, they're known for basically trying to boost their methane production within the wastewater treatment plant by going after, say, municipal organic waste, food waste. And that's a great way of basically thinking out of the box, you know, getting additional organic streams and boosting your methane production.
I think the ideal is to still use all water, but maybe to see it less in these categories of this is gray water and this is black water and this is green water and so on, that we'll get to the point that all water is valuable. But I think Daniel might be the best one to answer on gray water.
That. Because I also work with the U.S. Green Building Council, and we develop basically guidelines and LEED certification credits related to water reuse in green buildings. And that's a hot topic. And for green buildings, we would really like to encourage gray water reuse. For those of you who are not familiar, gray water has a strict definition of water coming from showers and sinks, sometimes laundry. It's basically a light fraction of the wastewater. And the thing with gray water reuse is that, you have to have the pipes in place, and you have to be able to do something with it. And for the average homes or buildings, those are not possible, you know, conventionally. You know, you want to basically just have the wastewater leave your premise and not see it again. So if you want to start to reuse that, you have to take on that responsibility of having the pipes, having some type of treatment system or some type of, you know, subsurface irrigation system or storage, something to handle the gray water. And if you want to take on that responsibility, great. You might be able to actually get green building credit for that. But for most of the population, the easier thing to do is to pass it down the sewer and let some type of, you know, municipal water recycling facility take care of it, such as we saw in L.A. or Singapore. So I think all of those are need to be considered. And I'll just borrow something from the presidential candidates, all of the above. But, you know, to recognize that the more recycling you want to do on site, the more responsibility you need to take on. And you need to make sure that you have the technical know-how, the resources allocated to do those things.
There's actually a guy at Oregon State University who blogs all about gray water. He has a wonderful blog about gray water, and I can't remember the name of the blog, but his name is Todd Jarvis. And his blog is fun to read, and he has all these different colors that he goes on with. Maybe the blog is something about a rainbow. But who else had their hand up? Yes, on this side of the room.
We have three principles, right? One is try to collect as much rainwater as we can. Two, try to collect back as much water as we can. Three, recycle as much water as we can. That's our big vision, right? Currently, the recycle rate as a system is about 50%. Right, currently is about 50%, because some of the water you lose through evaporation, aircon cooling, some of the water you lose when Coca-Cola bottles it and exports it. Right, so there are some losses in the system. One, two, some of the water is extremely difficult to treat, especially those from the industries. So you don't want to recycle that; it's very costly. Third, the higher you want to increase your recycling rate, the more energy you require. It's like squeezing a lemon or an orange. The first squeeze is cheaper, you use less energy. But as you want to squeeze more out, you will require a lot more energy. So on the balance, we are capable of recycling up to 50% of what we have now. Currently it's 30%, and we are progressively increase the use of new water. Right. So it's all economics rather than technical.
Ron?
Yes. Right now, in Los Angeles at West Basin, we use about 10% of what's wastewater that's produced. The rest goes to the ocean. Our goal eventually throughout Southern California is to recycle all that wastewater that's currently going to the ocean, and that would be close to the closed loops system. Well, we already capture stormwater, yes. Not all of it, but a great deal of it. We can't capture all of it because we've got too many places with asphalt and people. And there is times when we get an extraordinary amount of rain quickly. And in 1938, you could take a rowboat from inland to the ocean because of a massive flood. So we had to build a dam to protect the coastal area of L.A. and Orange County. But we have systems of lakes, and we have 9 groundwater basins in Southern California that the lakes are basically funnels down into the ground, and we capture as much stormwater as we can.
With that, I'm going to go to the reporter all the way in the back from L.A. County. Yeah, so the two questions are, what specifically would you like to see California do to allow direct? And number two, what about the unintended consequences of what we can't see, what you're not detecting? And those are for Ron, okay, or at least the first one.
I'll start off, and George can chime in. I'm very serious that when the water gets through microfiltration, reverse osmosis, and ultraviolet light with hydrogen peroxide, there's no endocrine disruptors. They're gone. That is the safest water we have available to us today. The problem of putting it directly into a pipe on a real-time basis is you've got to test it right before you release it. You've got to guarantee that high quality is there when it goes into that pipe. We need to develop a real-time water quality sensor that's instantaneous. And then we need to develop a storage facility for this water to test it and release it. If we do that, the health department will let us do direct potable. Right now we use the environment as the place that if there's a problem, we can check the water either in a reservoir or a groundwater basin and literally not use it isolated, clean it up, whatever. So we've got to get away from the environmental buffer and get a technical buffer.
George, would you like to comment as well?
We are watching what Ron does very closely before we move. Currently, because our non-domestic demand, that means the industry's demand, is 55% of our water consumption. So all our new water is used for the industries. We don't have near-term plans to use it for direct potable use. But maybe just to address the question of endocrine disruptors, if I may just paint this image, the pore size of the membrane is the size of, let's say, a tennis ball. Right? If you multiply it 100 million times, the pore size is a tennis ball. The water molecule is a ping pong ball. So the water molecule will be able to go through that pore size of a tennis ball. The endocrine disruptors, the equivalent size is like a football. It will not be able to get through the membrane. Virus is the size of a truck. It will not get through the membrane. A bacteria is the size of a building. It will not get through the membrane. So the membrane technology we have, we believe, is extremely, extremely safe. And even with new testing technologies, we can even test down to the parts per billion, parts per trillion, and we are quite confident that the water that we have is extremely safe.
Daniel is also going to answer the question.
So I think a lot of the issue with, you know, pharmaceutical compounds, endocrine disruptors, I can go on with, you know, 20 more names, microconstituents, emergent pollutants, is basically associated with sort of that we don't have an exact science on this. And when you don't have an exact science, then what? You know, the public might expect that you know 100% of that. And if you don't have 100%, should that prevent you from acting? So you mentioned the detection limits. In the past, we didn't have detection limits as low as we currently have. So it's possible those compounds were in the water previously, we didn't know about it, and we don't see it, you're okay with wastewater reuse. Going back to San Antonio, so a community is basically has its wastewater treated by the wastewater treatment plant. That may remove a fraction, but not all of the compounds. It gets released into the river, and then it gets taken up by a conventional water treatment plant that doesn't use membranes. And we just basically do that because, well, there really isn't a choice, and also, you know, we don't see it. So now the question is, now that we can see those things, you know, just because you can see it, should there be a health concern? And like you mentioned, there's a lot of disagreement within the communities. Part of it is that, well, we can't really do human subject testing on these compounds, and we don't really know at trace levels what they will cause. And, you know, so a lot of the data is extrapolation from, you know, laboratory animals and so forth. So, but like my colleagues mentioned, that those technologies are being used and I'll tell you, the systems in Singapore, Orange County, LA, those are really boutique systems. I mean, top of the, you know, not every community can afford those, but if you can afford those, you have those in there. I mean, pretty much nothing survives that. And so the thing about, you know, direct versus indirect is, I think a lot of times indirect is done for planning purpose, and also is to relieve any concerns, public concerns. You know, we have the saying, it's the kiss of nature, the blessing of nature. We put back in nature, and nature blesses it, and we kind of let it go, let Almighty take care of it. And then we're okay with it. But if we kind of put directly into the pipe, well, I don't know. You know, we don't quite trust that. There's also the terminology, river of amnesia. You know, once the wastewater enters the river, somehow all sins have been forgotten. And where did it come from? I don't know. It's been reclassified from wastewater effluent into river water. Wow, river water sounds pretty good as a drinking water source. So, you know, it's this river of amnesia that occurs. So a lot of it is really how we look at it.
Who's got another question? All the way in the back on the other side. It's a great question, how to make bioenergy, alternative energy from wastewater, able to compete with fossil fuel. What are the parts of the process where we might see that?
So as I mentioned, I think theoretically there's enough energy content stored within the wastewater to make wastewater treatment energy neutral and even energy surplus. And what we're looking at is, you know, we can actually use algae as a way to basically turn carbon dioxide, which is useless carbon from an energy perspective, back into useful carbon full of energy. So we can actually go into energy surplus if we bring algae into the picture. The question is really comes down to economics, competing with fossil fuels that are really low price right now. A lot of that is subsidized, and, you know, so now we get into politics. But beyond that, though, we need to look at what a wastewater treatment plant is being asked to do. You know, at a minimum, wastewater treatment plants are being asked to make water clean and meet all the very stringent effluent criteria with respect to nitrogen, going back to the Chesapeake Bay question. You know, that is the mission of a wastewater treatment plant, to make clean water, and as mandated by Clean Water Act. And anything beyond that is a luxury. You know, so they will make clean water at all costs, even if it consumes a lot of energy, even if it consumes a lot of chemicals. So a plant needs to sort of, you know, go beyond that. Say, okay, we're good at making clean water. Now we can start to recover the energy. You know, now we can look at sustainability, so forth. I think to kind of get to that point, we need to work with regulatory agencies, maybe redefine the mission of a wastewater treatment plant, you know, through incentives, through regulations that basically maybe broaden their role, go beyond making clean water and actually looking at wastewater as a resource and recover things. But regulatory agencies need to make that possible.
So as new communities have to build wastewater plants, bring wastewater plants online, why can't they do what East Bay has done in Northern California? Because they've done it, right?
They've done it, and so economics is one I mentioned. The other is really who's running the plant, and what does the community dictate? And I think for newer plants, we have more of that potential. But I can tell you, even within Tampa Bay, different communities think very differently. And in Southern California, Orange County thinks very differently than, say, San Diego. You know, so different communities demand different things from the utilities. And the other is also for existing plants. You know, if you want them to change and do more and go beyond making clean water, never underestimate the power of inertia. Basically, people don't want to change. And you can't blame them. You know, if a wastewater treatment process, you have to remember, is a 24/7. You can never turn it off. You know, it comes at you, and you have to make clean water at all costs. And if something is working, they're very reluctant to turn a screw because you might mess it up. So that is the type of pressure they're under.
Yes. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Daniel, would you like to take the question?
I think that's part of the solution, again, all of the above. And constructed wetlands are great because they're passive, and you are relying more on nature to do what nature does best. But there are limitations to constructed wetlands in terms of you need a significant area, land area, to treat that. So for it works for certain size of wastewater flows, but when you get into the millions of gallons, say on Los Angeles level, hundreds of millions of gallons flow, constructed wetlands will not work. We don't have enough land to make that possible. So you go to basically more technology. So I think it's not whether it decentralizes better or centralizes, not as good, or constructed wetlands versus activated sludge. It really is site specific and looking at what is the best technology to make that happen. But I think that's a great solution, especially for developing countries. A lot of them are using constructed wetlands.
Okay. Bill. Yeah, and I was actually going to say that as a last point. I think when we write about all the gee whiz technology, it's really important to remind readers or viewers that the number one thing, as Ron said, the best source of even new water is conserved water. So like you say, every gallon we don't use is a gallon that we don't have to build the new water plant or treat the wastewater. And so I think the important thing to remind readers and viewers is that there really are ways to live differently with water, and we're not doing some of those things. So that is the low-hanging fruit. What are the big targets? Yeah, agriculture is, as we heard here, so here in this community, agriculture is using 95% of the water. We went to the cotton farms using center pivot irrigation. We met cattle ranchers. One guy was not using any irrigated pasture land and moving his cattle around in the tradition of the way the buffalo moved around. The guy sitting right next to him saying, "Oh, I can't do that. I have to irrigate my pasture land." But clearly the other rancher was showing how it could be done. So ag is the biggie, but energy nationally is the other biggie. And then Daniel, I've worked with Daniel on several stories over the years, and he's helping people use a lot less water in urban settings. But I'll let that might be a good way to close the panel, to have each of you weigh in on what is the number one thing you think we could do to use a lot less water that will forestall the time that we have to. Yes, go ahead, Ron.
Okay, first of all, we're doubling our conservation program in the future, as well as our recycling program. Outside, that's where we're focused. We don't need lawns. The largest crop in the United States is lawns. I got that from her book, by the way. So we have a very active program with the surf riders to do ocean-friendly gardens and convert part of the lawns, maybe the front yard, to native plants, capture the water instead of having it run off. That's very. But we also do industrial efficiency. We go into there. We still do the home inside stuff, give away toilets, faucet aerators. But the lawns are our big target.
Water conservation is big in Singapore. We take a three-prong approach. One is pricing. That is, we make sure we price water to reflect its strategic value. So we price water based on the marginal cost. That means the next source of water, which is probably the most expensive source. So pricing is extremely important to drive behavior. Two, we have mandatory measures, like, for example, washing machines. We've got a labeling scheme to tell you which washing machine is more efficient, the type of taps, the shower heads, and so on. So there are some rules and regulations, mandatory. And, of course, voluntary education, starting from young, and so on. So we take a three-pronged approach to manage water demand. And we have seen a lot of success. The current per-person usage of water in Singapore is 153 litres per person per day. Our end of this decade, the target is 147, and by 2030, we hope to bring it down to 140 litres per person per day.
I think that, so we would use gallons. I think the translation is that the Singaporeans are using about 40 gallons of water per person per day, and Americans use about 150. And the Singaporeans cut that in half over 15 years or so ago. It is a very dramatic story. Daniel? Conservation?
I would say, you know, so I'm big on technology, but I would say the very first thing we need to do is more rainwater harvesting. It solves two things. One is it provides us alternative water supply that, hey, nature delivered right to your house, falls on your roof. Why do you want to let it run off and become stormwater and generate a stormwater pollution? And then have to harvest that water back in, right? So we can harvest rainwater, we can capture water source, and we can also reduce a stormwater problem. In the Tampa Bay area, for example, almost half of the water that's sent to houses are used on lawns, like Ron said. So that's water that could be met by, you know, rainwater harvesting. If, you know, let's say every house has a cistern, we can do that. So now you get into why don't we do that? Well, it's because, you know, the communities don't think about doing that, or there might be local ordinances that maybe even prohibit cisterns. So it gets really into this kind of social questions beyond just technology.
So I want to give our panelists a great round of applause for coming so far. All three of them really came a long way.